Hello and welcome to the SRA podcast. Today we have a very special episode recorded live last week at the SRA convention in Denver, Colorado. This was our first ever national convention, and it was a great event. About 50 organizers and our national leadership team came together to talk shop, make plans, hear petitions, and sing karaoke. It was a lot of fun, we got a lot accomplished, and here's hoping for an even bigger and better convention next year. Joining me on the stage for this panel is Alex Humva, president of the SRA, and Brett O'Shea, host of the Rev Left Radio and Red Menace podcasts. We had some hiccups during the live streaming of this panel, so we apologize for any audio issues. All that said, enjoy!
Now with live studio audience.
Yes, I am Brett. I host a couple podcasts, Revolutionary Left Radio and Red Menace. I'm also one of the founding members of the Nebraska SRA chapter. And yeah, that's pretty much me.
I'm Faye. I'm the current host of the SRA podcast. Currently the only podcast I host. I also am one of the lead organizers for the Los Angeles chapter of the SRA.
I do not do a podcast right now because Faye took over the SRA podcast forcibly, but I am working on a narrative podcast that's been in the works for a little while of describing a syndicalist post, or you know, kind of a alternative potential whatever syndicalist future of the North American continent. So
I think our format for this is pretty much going to be question and answer. If any of you would like to know our thoughts on any recent news events, on any sort of political theory thing, you know, anything about the SRA, anything that you want to know, pitch us a topic, and then we'll go ahead and we'll give you our thoughts on that, spend maybe 10, 15, 20 minutes per topic.
It's also literally a Q&A. You can ask anything. It doesn't have to be the org business. You can ask personal questions, detailed questions, podcast questions, whatever.
We good? Oh, there we go. Okay. My name is Noah Madison, Wisconsin, SRA. Doing the podcast that both of you do, I'm wondering what challenges that you've faced in making that work, and what advice you have for people who are trying to start, you know, media or especially leftist media in general.
As for the challenges, I mean, they're sort of what you expect. As far as like having a platform, I always say like I was sort of surprised when Rev Left sort of gained steam, and I realized that, you know, having a platform on the left oftentimes means that some of your harshest, most, you know, vile critics will be of your own kind, right, on the left itself. And that's sort of been hard. I'm a pretty sensitive person overall, and so, you know, sometimes the toxic stuff online can be really discouraging, and sometimes, you know, you wonder if it's worth it. That's one problem. There's also the reactionary side, of course, you know, with doxings and targetings and stuff, which I've, you know, been the target of as well. So those are some obstacles. And your other question was some advice to, yeah. I think people should, whatever your talents are, try to apply it to the cause, right? Not everybody needs to be, obviously, a podcaster. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of hitting its plateau as far as how many podcasts can possibly occur at one time. But that's also a good thing because it means that the left is sort of gaining its own feet, you know, having its own narratives, being able to talk to itself, especially in a fractured media landscape. That's super important. But I like people to see what talents and interests they have and then the unique or creative way that you can apply it to the cause. So I guess that'd be some initial thoughts at least.
Yeah, and as far as media projects in particular, one of the most important aspects is, you know, being able to put in the time and put out like consistent content and put your heart into it. You know, you don't need to compete with, you know, big name content producers in terms of your production quality or anything right out the gate. But if you're starting a media project, you know, the most important part is to keep at it and keep putting in the work, because when you start, it will be small. You know, you won't get a lot of people at first, But as you, you know, put more content out there, as you get more people who are interested in what you're putting out and are sharing it with their friends and are sharing it with others, your audience will grow. And you just need to put in that effort and put in the effort to, like, also, you know, self-promotion and reach out to other people and expand that audience. So, and definitely, like Brett said, you want to definitely focus on your strengths, on your knowledge. You know, if you enjoy listening to, like, a podcast that's focused on theory, you know, if you're not necessarily all that knowledgeable out there yourself, you don't, you know, don't feel like you have to do what others have already been, you know, already been doing. Look at what there's a space for. Look at what there's a need for in the leftist media landscape. If there's a, you know, like, is, I don't know, is there a leftist cooking channel out there? If you have those skills and you know, you can go on YouTube and you can do that and tie that into leftist politics or any other hobby like that, you know, I think that every sort of venture like that is possible, because if you can build those connections into people's hobbies and people's interests, that's how you bring people, you know, into leftist politics. I mean, look at Jim Sterling with gaming and how he's sort of bringing people into the fold in that regard. So, you know, I think there's a lot of good that can be done in the media landscape. But I do think we're hitting a plateau on podcasts.
But I do want to echo that idea of, like, finding a different doorway in. Like, there's lots of different podcasts, but they all offer a different doorway. So you could have a leftist film podcast or a leftist, you know, literature podcast, or one that's focused on philosophy or history or, you know, cooking or even sports, you know, gaming. Anything that can offer a door in that people that might not be interested in, like, here's a hardcore communist podcast, but is interested in some other things, and then you get them in, you know, they start to get used to you, you sort of have a community of people interested in that thing, and then you use that as a doorway to connect it up to broader politics. You know, that can be really effective, and I've seen that with some of our spinoff podcasts, how effective that can be, finding the right doorway for people to come into the left that isn't alienating or scary or too much at once.
Wasn't addressed the question, and now I've completely forgotten what the question was. So,
we have some questions on the Slack.
Okay.
The first one, someone's asking, have you any of you had any IRL threats for your political beliefs while using spaces typically occupied by chuds, such as gun ranges, etc.?
I haven't had explicit threats at a shooting range. I have gotten unfriendly and cold treatment once an employee realized, like, if I was wearing an SRA pin that I forgot to take off. You can definitely tell when someone keys into your politics and is suddenly hostile to you. I haven't received any threats in that context, although some members of the committee have received threats along those lines, but I think that would be up to them to discuss.
Yeah, I mean, me personally, some people might know this, but, you know, I've definitely been the not necessarily on a gun range situation, but the target of, like, you know, neo-Nazis in my community targeting me, multiple doxes, my family's house being put up on the Daily Stormer, my mom's name, neo-Nazis writing letters to my mom, menacing letters about how they're going to come visit her and mete out the punishment on her for raising a son like me. That stuff can be incredibly hurtful and scary. You know, if it's just me by myself, that's one thing. But if it's my mom and my kids and, you know, my fiance, it can get very scary. As for being out on the gun range or in, you know, technically more right-wing reactionary areas, some of us, like with me, I'm just a white dude. So maybe I'm able to fit in better than somebody that is, you know, has a different identity than me. And that could be, you know, much harder for them. But I think regardless, it does put an onus on us to try to create ranges and places where we can go that is super inclusive. And I would like to see, you know, if we're a part of this bubbling up of leftist gun culture, I would like to see that, you know, the next level be having our own brick and mortar ranges, you know, having the places that we can go that are, you know, obviously inclusive, that we make it known right away that we're inclusive, we don't put up with any bigotry of any sort. And that's the next step, I think, that we should take to make sure that people have a safe place that they can go to and learn these things. And I know a lot of these wonderful chapters out here have been doing that in various ways, and, you know, keep it up.
Yeah, absolutely. As far as, like, physical range infrastructure, having, like, a physical space, that's challenging just because land is capital and it's a lot of money involved. I can say that if anybody does have those resources and is willing to, you know, step out on that endeavor, the SRA will be happy to put its support behind you and, you know, give you any help that we can give you to get that off the ground and get people going there. But in the meantime, I mean, even just having a community of people, you know, just being able to go to the range in a group with people that you can trust, with people that you know have your back, honestly, I think that's one of the most valuable things that we're doing right now. And we are also working on one of our many projects is we are trying to create a system where people can essentially review ranges and let people know if a range or a gun store is particularly unfriendly or particularly Nazi-ish, because we've run into a couple of those.
Definitely. Public land is a great alternative, too. If there are reactionary gun ranges that you don't feel comfortable going to, public land, if you can find it, like in Nebraska, it's fairly easy. You're right, a lot of it is owned by somebody. But there are little places, and like our chapter goes out to public land almost every time, which is nice. And in Omaha, they're one of the gun ranges, the biggest gun range, is called like Tactical 88. And they have the Omaha Police Department go there and train police there. And then they've also brought in Islamophobic speakers to talk about the threat of Islam, and they use that place as like their, you know, their go-to. We had some comrades go and infiltrate one of those meetings just to see what they were up to, and it's just horrific Islamophobia and just bigotry, far right-wing paranoia and conspiracy nonsense. So yeah, you do got to be careful about that, unfortunately. But you're right, going in groups, I mean, solidarity, having a community makes you feel a lot safer.
Absolutely.
I don't think I've had anything happen at a gun range, but as some folks are aware, I had about 3 months ago now, I think. It was right when I started. Yeah, it was about 3 months ago. There was two men who came to my apartment complex right around shift change time, so right before I came to work, or got out of work, as it were. And they attempted to open the door on my apartment, and my wife texted me and was like, "Are you trying to get in?" I was like, "No, I'm not even there yet." And as I found out, so thankfully we have a fairly good maintenance crew, and we're near their office. And basically what happened was one of the maintenance guys was walking back and asked what's up, and they walked away. We're unaware of what affiliation those folks did, but usually when you have two guys trying to get into somebody's house, that's a cause for concern. I'm sorry not to be able to provide any other further information than that. That's all I really know, that besides, you know, the fact that they were trying to get in, and it was broad daylight at 3 o'clock in the day, so like, I don't think it's common burglars.
And targeted your apartment. There's any footage, any video footage from the...
But I think that just is, you know, a thing for folks to keep in mind, that we can definitely see the news and see that as the left continues to rise in this country, there will be a reaction, and we must prepare ourselves for what that reaction will inevitably be, which is part of the reason why we're here.
Especially when it comes to leftists arming themselves and educating one another on how to be competent in self-defense. The right hates that, and we've seen that with the SRA specifically, and you see it all the time. And I mean, in history, like when the Black Panthers started arming themselves, I mean, Reagan, right? Small government guy, what did he do? In California, he went and banned, you know, started putting regulations on who can have guns and where you can have them, because they scared the shit out of them, you know? But the right, I mean, they can open carry, they can do whatever they want, and there's nobody hardly bats an eye. So we have a precarious position that we're in.
One of the best things that we can do to deal with, you know, situations like that, as well as the situations you've been in, you know, just building connections in your community, having people that you can call, you know, who can, you know, come and help check out a situation, figure out what's going on, you know, having people that you can rely on, you know, just having a community that you can, you know, call people up and you can have those sort of connections and those sort of people who can come and check out your apartment. Like, there was the situation in Philadelphia where the Proud Boys went to an activist's home, an anti-fascist activist went to her, you know, Proud Boys went to her apartment. She had that, you know, relationship with her neighbor who was able to, you know, scope out the situation, realize, oh, these are bad guys, and then call her and let her know what's going on. You know, building community, not just within, you know, organizations like ours, but also just get to know the people around you, get to know the people who live near you, the people who you work with. You know, the working class is everywhere, and we should be building connections everywhere with everyone that we can, and, you know, building those networks of solidarity, because at the end of the day, that's what we have to fall back and rely on when we can't rely on the state or the police.
Yeah, in fact, after my first docs, it was comrades that eventually later we became members of the SRA, some of them. But, you know, having that community there was so important, because, and I have little kids, and, you know, we have to sleep at night. And so I had friends come over and basically, you know, stand watch. So my address is being posted on these hardcore neo-Nazi websites. And so, you know, my armed friends came over and they sat on my couch all night while me and my family slept. And we did that for a few nights in a row. And that's a beautiful thing, to have that sort of connection, that ability to have people who have your back and will actually come in and, you know, protect your family at the drop of a hat. And that's what this is all about. That's what we're trying to build, you know?
All right, now you're ready for next question?
Sure.
So this one's from YouTube. It looks like some people are already chiming in with pretty good answers. So someone asked, has anyone tried incorporating theory into their range days or outside range days? I know you run the risk of sectarian conflicts, but what are your thoughts on that?
Personally, we haven't done that in my chapter yet. We have a lot of people in various DSA chapters, and they do theory through those. But I don't think it's a bad idea, as long as people can approach it with a, you know, critical and non-sectarian lens. You know, as long as people can, you know, be mature about it and not necessarily, you know, start fights, but like studying like common Marxist or common anarchist works, you know, really core texts, and really understanding that and taking the lessons from it, rather than picking a side, like, well, I'm going to stand with Marx because I'm a Marxist-Leninist, or I'm going to stand with Kropotkin or whatever, but like reading the text and actually pulling the lessons out of it. What can I learn from this theorist? What can I apply to my organizing today and to our current political situation? You know, really applying, you know, reading theory is one thing, but applying theory is what is most important. Because if you just read theory to form opinions, well, everyone has an opinion, and it's not really helping anything. What's important is being able to take those, you know, those lessons and apply it to what we're currently doing.
And in fact, that's how we learn, right? The sort of dialectic between theory and practice, going out, carrying out these ideas, seeing how they work, coming back and adjusting theory. I haven't done it in the SRA chapter specifically, but we have done like workout events where a bunch of comrades would get together. And what we actually did last summer was we'd read snippets of Mao's Combat Liberalism, and we'd like read like a passage or two, and then we'd do our workout, and we'd be able to think about that passage. And at the end of our workout, we'd come together, and then we'd all discuss maybe ways that, you know, what Mao was talking about with regards to liberalism as manifested in our lives and our politic, and working through that was really interesting. And so it can be a really fun experience to sort of combine those things, whether that's at the range or that's just working out with your comrades and weaving theory into that. And I mean, sectarianism, it's not so much an issue in real life, you know? If you're online, it feels like, holy shit, how could I ever talk to somebody of a different tendency? But once you get in real life, you realize, you know, there's social consequences for being an asshole. People generally want to be nice and kind and assume the best. So, you know, the disparity between sort of sectarianism that erupts online and real life organizing is so, I mean, it's complete opposites. And so, yeah, I don't worry about that so much. And we have organizations with anarchists, Maoists, Marxist-Leninists, even social democrats of various sorts, and that's never been an issue that's been divisive. It might be jocular, joking around, making jokes, like, you know, sort of lighthearted discussions or debates, but yeah, never anything beyond that in real life, in my experience at least.
I mean, Alex, when you and Brad and Oso did the hurricane relief effort, what's that, Hurricane Florence, I mean, we're able to sit down and like work together as, you know, as a committee, despite wildly different political tendencies.
Yeah, so I mean, currently as the SRA Central Committee is set up, we have an anarchist, a libcom, a syndicalist, and then three varying flavors of Marxist-Leninist. Our directors as well have their own tendencies, and our legal director is a Trotskyist, so.
Oh, no, he's isn't he a Demsoc?
Oh, he says he's a Trotskyist.
Oh.
Unless he was joking.
I'm sorry, he's canceled.
But anyways, we have a variety of flavors. We still get out and do things. And yeah, when we went to Georgia, that was definitely a thing that we were able to, Yeah, so when we went out to Georgia, we were able to do stuff just fine. I mean, there's not really a whole lot of ideological problems with going out and delivering food and supply. I mean, that's just regular direct action is usually not ideologically based. I mean, you're only going to get really edge case hardline ideologies where you're going to have serious concerns about giving food to hungry people. And if your ideology says you can't give food to hungry people because you might impact some future immaterial condition, then you should probably rethink your ideology. But just my two cents on that. I'd say as far as the idea of putting ideology into practice with range days, maybe looking at it from a slightly different perspective, I think that we ought to take the idea of that not from a tendency standpoint of how do we incorporate this particular tendency into things, but taking the stance of we can sit here and talk about how to make firearm culture more inclusive. We can talk about how to make a more diverse culture. But at the end of the day, there is a limitation to what talk will do, and we have to actually be able to put that stuff into action. And I think that's where the intersection of ideology and gun range days should be. It shouldn't necessarily be how do I get us to read Marx or Kropotkin or whoever at the range day. I think it's the point of going ahead and taking Marx's words that until, you know, however the quote goes, it's on his gravestone, philosophers have only thought about the world. It is on for us to change. We have to be able to change that. So take your theory and then actually do something with it is my thoughts and opinions.
Absolutely.
Next question. All right, so Luke from North Carolina asked, what radicalized and inspired you to do the work that you do?
Big question.
So for me, I was a social democrat prior to the 2016 elections. In the wake of those elections, I was subject to a couple of transphobic assaults, at least one that was explicitly transphobic, another one that I think was possibly because of a Bernie bumper sticker, I'm not sure, but I had a bottle thrown at me, I had someone swerve at me in their car on the road, and, you know, I sort of saw this, you know, rising fascist movement in America, and I looked at what the Democratic Party was doing, and I thought, God, how can anyone be so useless? So that was sort of what, you know, inspired me to start thinking about these things, and particularly after I watched the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville on a live stream, I think Emily Gorsensky's stream, and just seeing that and seeing the useless response to it from, you know, the electoral complex, and you know, I knew that, you know, it's up to us really to defend ourselves. We can't rely on the police to protect us. We can't rely on, you know, government or elections necessarily to protect us. And so that's really why I started getting into the SRA and started, you know, putting work into organizing. I think I started trying to start a chapter of the Trigger Warning Queer and Trans Gun Club. We had gotten like three people together, but the other two dropped out. And, you know, I got together with Scott and with JL Hamilton, and we started the SRA in its current form. And, you know, we've taken it from there, and I'm proud of what we've been able to do with it so far. You know, at the end of the day, our unofficial motto is we keep us safe, and that really sums up my approach to everything that we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, as far as me, what radicalized me broadly, I mean, there's a bunch of, like, personal parts of my life that, you know, pushed me in this direction over and over again. But at the end of the day, it boils down, at least in my case, to radical empathy. Like, what pushed me into action was just my love for other human beings and like my just sort of repulsiveness at innocent people suffering for no reason. It always bothered me. I sort of was a sensitive kid with like a big heart that cared about other people. And then as things developed, as politics developed, I'm a little older than some, so it wasn't really the Bernie thing that pushed me to the far left. It was like Obama. Because I remember in 08, you know, going, listen to his speeches. It was like my daughter was being born, and I really thought like, oh, wow, you know, something might actually change here. And I was sort of excited about that. And then, you know, we all know what happened with regards to that. So I was, you know, I was moving leftward, like right after Obama. But it really is like, you know, like Che said himself, like, you know, it sounds silly to say, but the revolutionary is guided by a great sense of love. And I think, like, when I meet leftists, regardless of their tendency, when they're putting in work, the common trait is, like, a big heart. Like, you give a fuck about other people. And somebody else's suffering is your own suffering. And that goes a long way to pushing somebody into action when you just can't stand back and watch this shit anymore. And then Charlottesville, I remember I was getting my car worked on, and I was sitting in you know, just a little waiting area when you're waiting for your car to get finished, when Charlottesville was happening on the TV as on CNN. Whew. I mean, that was a hard day. Like I saw that, I watched the murder of Heather Heyer, and I mean, ooh, yeah, very, very tough. And that really pushed me in the direction of actually organizing specifically towards an SRA ethos of self-defense and this idea that we must protect ourselves and that, you know, this bigotry can't stand and we're not gonna sit back and let that shit go without being challenged, you know?
I never really had a radicalizing moment, honestly. It's just kind of been a slow drift towards leftism, in particular syndicalism. I've always been a very strong proponent of unions, and that's just kind of the path that it's guided me down to, is that it honestly doesn't take very much to go from the idea that workers should bargain for their collective rights to then figuring out, well, why do we have to bargain with the boss if we could just elect our own boss and own this? And that's basically what's gotten me to my current political theory, that there's just a natural progression, as I see it, from the unions we have today to whatever socialist world we have tomorrow. And that's a future I'd like to work towards, is where you don't get, you know, 8 hours of your life or more a day ruled over by a petty despot that is unaccountable except to their own petty despots above them. That's just, I never really had a radicalizing moment where I woke up and said that. I just don't particularly like being lorded over by a petty despot, is basically how that happened, and just went from there. Certainly, as the political discourse has gotten more open about being just very vile in this country, as we kind of continue to pull the veil away and people begin to realize what has been going on. I don't know necessarily if I've always held the same opinions on firearms. That I think when I was younger, I did have more of a naive understanding that, well, if we could just get rid of all the guns, then things would be okay. And as you can tell in our comrades in Europe, things are not okay just because they took away all the guns. I don't think the alt-right and fascist groups out there much care, one, for gun regulation, or two, for the fact that, you know, they still just beat people in the street. But that's not the sort of violence liberals will talk about, and that's one of the things that pushed me away from this liberalistic notion of, well, we just ban weapons and that'll fix violence. Unfortunately, still end up expressing violence one way or the other, be it physical or political. My father used to be much more involved in advocacy work in the Cherokee Nation, and that influenced me from a young age, that as grim as it may sound, my first bedtime stories was that my dad had a book of all of the Native war chiefs from beginning of colonization to the end of the Indian Wars in the 1800s. And it was just, each one would have a few pages dedicated to their life story and how they usually ended up dying in battle, trying to fight people away. And that's something that's tied directly into my family history, And I mean, it's kind of hard to say trust the government, that they'll keep you safe, that they have guns and they'll keep you safe from bad people who have guns, when the bad people who have guns were the people who were killing your ancestors. So
yeah, I would just add to that, like, you know, like right-wing violence is baked into the cake, right? Like from the genocide, from slavery, from lynchings, to brutal imperialism today, in the liberal mindset, right-wing violence is just taken for granted. And that is why you see liberals lose their minds when, you know, somebody dressed in all black punches somebody in the face and they say, oh, that's political violence. We can't stand for that. But meanwhile, you know, we're teaming up with Saudi Arabia to cluster bomb kids in Yemen. You know, the entire history of the United States is built on brutal right-wing, reactionary, white supremacist, settler colonial violence. And when the left just picks up a gun and says, okay, not me, oh, whoa, what's going on? You know, the left is getting crazy. This is not the left I know. And it's so predictable. It's so ridiculous. And that really attests to that idea that we have to save us, because these liberal politicians, even people that like to put on this progressive facade and believe in some of the same things we do, when push comes to shove, they're not going to be there for us, you know. So we have to be there for us. And yeah.
Cool.
Okay, so I'm going to skip ahead. We'll go back to older questions. But a lot of people want to know, can more be done to have those who may be slightly left of center, i.e. liberals or Democrats, in general, feel more welcomed should they decide to join? Or is there an ideological, quote, cutoff point for accepting members?
So I've gotten a couple questions over the Slack regarding this as well. There are people who are driven off by the logo being evocative of Soviet imagery, or there are people who are, you know, wary of joining a group that has a central committee, even if it's just a renamed board of directors, really. But it's the sort of thing that's sort of a decision that we'll have to make as an organization, like how much do we want to dedicate to, you know, being this radical organization with radical imagery and radical rhetoric, and how much do we want to water that down to appeal to a broader audience? You know, I do think that we need to appeal to a large audience of people, and a lot of those people are not going to be what you'd consider a doctrinaire leftist. You know, at the end of the day, you look at people who self-identify as communists or anarchists or Marxists or whatever, you know, from the research that I've done on different organizations, I'd say that there's less than 100,000, you know, dedicated self-identifying radical leftists who are engaged in any sort of who are engaged in any sort of work beyond online, you know, sectarian arguments. If the radical left wants to grow beyond that, we are going to have to find ways to be inclusive to more groups of people, but we need to figure out who we want to be inclusive to. Do we want to bring in, largely white, social democratic, middle class, you know, people, or do we want to reach out to vulnerable communities? Do we want to reach out to the trans community, the black community, the immigrant community, you know, to people who, you know, directly suffer that sort of oppression? Do we want to try to incorporate those people into the SRA and into the, you know, into the left in general? I think I think that that's a better route, but I do think that there's also some merit to the idea of, you know, having that sort of, you know, appeal to more moderate social democrats. I don't think that's entirely a bad idea, but I think it's something that the organization will have to come to a consensus on as a community. I don't think that's something that, you know, we as the leadership should impose on below.
And it's a little different than like a party or like an organization that's doing like mass work, in that, you know, having liberals infiltrate or be in those organizations can really, you know, steer the ship in a wrong way. It can really default to a sort of liberalism, and we've seen that time and time again. I mean, look at the CPUSA, you know, telling us to vote for Hillary. It's absurd. That's what happens when liberalism gets into your org. But the SRA is a little different. It's a formation about, you know, fundamentally about, you know, protecting ourselves, being competent with self-defense, learning firearm safety. And so in that context, I don't think that there's a real threat with having well-meaning social democrats or liberals come over if they're willing to, you know, to back us up in what our basic beliefs are. But I totally agree with Faye, like the energy and the direction should be focused on, you know, marginalized communities, people that really need it, not white middle-class liberals. But if a white middle-class liberal says, hey, I really like what you guys are doing, I want to become involved, there's no reason, you know, in a formation like this why, you know, we should say no.
One of the members in the Los Angeles chapter that has been really helpful with organizing range days and with educating people, someone with a lot of experience. He's a, he's a liberal. He's someone who joined the SRA because the local liberal gun club is inactive. And, you know, he doesn't necessarily agree with all of our politics, but he's someone who's willing to stand with us, who's interested in educating people who are in marginalized groups, who are part of, you know, non-traditional political spaces, and is willing to, you know, put his guns and his knowledge out there for people to learn and train and, you know, improve their skills. So there's definitely a space for that. I don't think we should deliberately drive those people away, but maybe it's not something that we should necessarily focus on attracting those people.
Hi there, I'm Rob with the SF Bay SRA, and I just want to echo on what the panel has said. I speak for our chapter in that when we have interest from liberal and Democrat folks in our community, we like to remind them that owning a gun for our chapter is not a requirement. But you know, we are first and foremost an educational organization, and so we want to share that knowledge of safe firearms ownership and handling with working people. And so that's been pretty effective means of reaching out to people who are curious. And again, you know, those same folks are coming from groups that are often marginalized, communities of women or people of color who haven't felt safe pursuing those curiosities regarding this kind of knowledge. And so just that little bit of a reminder goes a long way. Yeah. So I just wanted to echo off y'all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Definitely agree.
Can you hear me? Yes. I'm Sarah, they, them. I'm from the Front Range chapter. I was hoping to ask two questions, if that would be permitted. The first one is, living under capitalism, you three, and probably to some extent everybody in this room and everybody listening, is very hyper aware of basically how fucked up everything is, and you spend a lot or even the vast majority of your time interacting with that very directly and being very aware of that. What do you do to take care of your mental health and your personal relationships when you're so like devoted to something so inherently kind of heartbreaking, you know?
Do you want to ask your second one too, and or do you want to wait?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You want to go?
So as far as like self-care and you know maintaining your sanity and your relationships and everything, you know it's really important to do what you need to do first, then do what you can do, and then put the rest of that time towards taking care of yourself. You know, I work a full-time job, 40 hours a week. I'm fortunate in that my job is very feast or famine. I'm either slammed working the entire week or I have nothing going on at all. So, you know, it sort of varies how much of a toll that takes. But, you know, even though it's not something that I necessarily care about, I have to, you know, put that time and put that energy into my job because that's what I need to do to take care of myself and the people that I love. And beyond that, I put all the energy that I can into the Socialist Rifle Association, into other organizing, like with the local DSA and other organizations. And I put in the energy that I can, and it can be really difficult sometimes. You know, I feel an obligation. Like I need to, there's so much in this world that is broken, that is wrong, that is unjust, and I feel like I have to do something to, you know, I feel like I have a responsibility to try to fix it. And that's a good motivating force, but if you give into it entirely, you will burn yourself out. And I've burned myself out or come close a couple of times. So it's important when you feel yourself reaching to that point, you need to take the time to rest, take the time to do a mental reset and focus on yourself and the ones that you love. And find that balance. And there's times where I've had to step back from organizations that matter to me that I thought were important because I just didn't have the time or the physical or mental energy to you know, put in that work, then I had to focus on what are the core things that I need to work on, you know, on top of the things that I have to do to stay alive. And you really, you know, you really have to find that balance.
Yeah, one of the problems is I think like we always expect so much of ourselves. Like we hold ourselves to such high standards. Like no matter how much I do with political education and organizing, and you know, I really do a lot. I do as much as I possibly can. I always, there's a voice in the back of your head saying you're not doing enough, you know? And so that we got to be like sort of not as hard on ourselves about that. Like do what you can and then realize that we're building these communities so that you can sort of take a rest, so other people can pick up the slack and, you know, sort of ebb and flows like that. One way that we do it like sort of structurally and organizationally in Omaha is our main organization. We make sure to take times where we do fun events, like Comrade Karaoke, we call it, or, you know, the People's Potluck. And these are times where you can get together with your comrades who you're doing a lot of this work with, but not have to focus on that and just sort of focus on building those bonds, having fun, blowing off steam, getting to know each other as, like, human beings, not just as, you know, rabid organizers. So building that structurally into whatever you're doing in the organization you're doing it in goes a long way in preventing some of that, you know. You don't want to have, you know, the gas pressed to the bottom all the time. You need organizational areas where you guys can just hang out and be human beings together. And then I also think taking social media breaks does help. Because when you're in this mindset of burnout and you go and you're scrolling through a social media feed, it really plays to the worst of that. It really plays to the sense of, oh my God, the world is burning, you know, this frantic, anxiety-inducing, you know, engagement with these social media platforms, which is how they make their money and how they actually structure their algorithms to do that to you. So taking a break from that can be helpful. You know, I make sure that I dedicate time every day to spending it with my kids, you know, putting my phone down, going, you know, jumping through the sprinkler, taking them out to the woods, doing something with my kids and being totally present in that moment, and that can be rejuvenating as well. Spending time with your family and friends and being a human being, you have to be okay if you're going to be an effective organizer. You have to take these times out to really, you know, ground yourself and you know, orient your perspective to what really matters, and then that can be a rejuvenating thing that you can then use to jump back into organizing when you're ready. So there's no quick answer to that. Everybody sort of has to find their own balancing point on that one, but those are at least some directions you can go in. Yeah, did you have a second question?
Oh, yeah, the second question.
The second question I had is that historically, especially in this country, I think gun culture has been very much associated with a particular type of masculinity, and it's been, you know, it's a male-dominated space, and I think even in the SRA, just sort of demographically, it's a male-dominated space still, so. How do you, in your organizing and when you're talking to people and trying to promote community defense and challenge those structures, how do you cultivate a space for self-defense that genuinely confronts patriarchy and doesn't present like a, you know, like, the right-wing spaces don't have a space for women and LGBTQ+, et cetera. But here we have men who give those people a space, you know. How do you really challenge those structures in a meaningful way? How do you avoid falling into just sort of a softened version of what the right is offering?
Great question.
You want to take a shot at it?
I'll take a shot at it, yeah. So one that's very important, right? And there's, machismo exists, especially in the gun culture, especially in the American gun culture. Think about the history of guns in this country. It really is this frontier idea, you know, from like John Wayne films all the way to hyper-violent pop cultural films today. There is this sort of American male fantasy of violence and of dominating others and of getting your way through explicit acts of violence. And that's deeply embedded into our culture and into our psyches. I know personally, you got to start sort of with yourself as like me, you know, I'm a cis white dude. I have to do some of that internal work, and I have comrades, you know, our NLC organization is dominated and led by women and members of the LGBTQ community, and being embedded in that organization, following their lead, you know, listening and playing my role and not, you know, not letting my sort of ingrained conditioned machismo dominate what I do, that goes a long way. And you know, building healthy organizations is part of it. You want organizations with a diverse range of people so that your inculcated white supremacy or your inculcated patriarchy or whatever can be worked sort of structurally. That's why I keep coming back to this idea of like building these things into our organizational structures. And that's one way to do it. Again, there's no quick, easy way, but I think we all have a responsibility to ourselves and to our comrades, especially as you know, cis men, to work on ourselves and then to go in our communities, learn from people who weren't socialized that way, and you know, be humble. That's a big thing. Put your ego aside. There's no place on the left for huge egos and narcissism. On the right, have you seen some of the chats that get leaked from? Everybody wants to be the next Hitler. Everybody wants to be the next big guy, the big machismo leader, and all these right-wing groups fracture into a million little pieces because you realize when you get a bunch of assholes off the internet and you put them in one place, they fucking suck and everything goes to shit. And so we can't replicate that. And our strength is our diversity. Our strength is our consciousness of how limiting that shit is. And our strength is in our humility and our willingness to serve others, right? That's what it should come down to. And doing that internal work is part of that process.
Absolutely. And another thing that we can do is we can try to, you know, sort of reach out to people in your chapter who are members of a marginalized community and make sure that you're, you know, offering what they are coming to you to find, you know? People come to the SRA looking for different things, and it's really important to make sure if, someone who's a person of color or someone who's queer is coming to the organization, make sure that we are meeting their needs, because that's really what we're here for, is to help marginalized communities defend themselves. And another thing is, it really does help to have representation in your chapter membership and your chapter leadership. So in Los Angeles, we have had the issue of a lot of our organizers and members being men, and you know, trying to build a diverse group can be a challenge. But I have had a lot of success being, you know, a queer trans woman. I've had a lot of success talking to people who are like me, and you know, helping them stick around and helping them get what they are looking for out of the SRA. You know, if there's a person in your chapter who is a member of a marginalized group who you think might be interested, or, you know, might have good skills to share to become an organizer, you know, definitely try and give them every opportunity to shine, you know. Definitely, you know, try to give that preference. You know, obviously don't turn away someone who's good at what they do, but if there's someone who's a member of a marginalized group, you know, try and give them those opportunities to become a leader, to become more skilled and more competent, and to share those abilities with others. And that's really how you increase diversity in the group, because when people look at an organization like us, the people who will be attracted to our organization are the people, you know, it'll be people who look like who's already here. I think I phrased that weirdly, but
makes sense.
Yeah.
I think that SRA, definitely we can just see from our demographics that there's a ways to go on some stuff. I am proud of the fact that we have been able to reach the LGBTQ community very effectively. A third of our membership identifies in some way in the community. Our racial demographics, at least as of the last demographic survey, have more or less gotten to national standards. America, at least as of the 2010 census, was 78% white, and that's about where we're sitting at. I would like to see improvement in that area, though, given that if you want a vast majority white gun group, then there's plenty of those already out there. I think that a problem of outreach we have, and this applies to many marginalized groups, but I also feel like applies to reaching out to, you know, right now I think we're sitting at 80% male identified members as of the last demographic. So 20% of our members identify as female or other. We have a few options on there. I think one of the things that I've been personally thinking about a lot recently is, when reaching out to women, there is a problem in America of how the gun culture has been so thoroughly coded masculine. Like, you can go to the NRA and they have their little pink pistol, self-defense, whatever thing, it's... I don't want to besmirch any attempts, even if they are by a thoroughly reactionary and shit organization, to train women to be able to defend themselves. But there is a problem in America that by having coded firearms culture so thoroughly masculine, if you go to your regular, you know, middle class, quote unquote, suburban house life or whatever other token, whatever example you want to go look at of your just your average white woman, perhaps in America, this is kind of also coded on racial grounds as well. There, I feel like in American culture right now, because victimhood is so heavily emphasized and is itself so heavily coded, yes, you have these right-wing organizations that emphasize, oh, well, yeah, our women can defend themselves too, but it's not actually, you know, we want everyone to be able to defend themselves. I don't actually believe that the folks running the NRA's program are of as sincere heart when it comes to these things, that these outreach efforts are political moves on their part. It's not because, and it's difficult to phrase this in a way that makes sense and gets my thoughts across on the field on this well, but I guess it's the idea that we exist to fill that vacuum where we actually have a genuine desire to see marginalized groups be able to protect themselves. The way the NRA, in some ways, the USCCA, though they do much better in my opinion, and as well as like the NSSF and other these other organizations, it's a very much political posturing on their parts. If you look at the funding that goes into these programs, I think that's an important thing to look at too. The funding does not compare anywhere to even like, you know, just other general, you know, unrelated almost topics that the NRA, don't quote me on this, this might be inaccurate, but as I understand, the NRA spends more to distribute t-shirts and other promotional material than it does in their women's only self-defense courses, which, you know, you can make arguments one or the other, but I'm kind of just rambling at this point. But.
I think that a good way to understand what the NRA is doing is that they're not really focused on empowering women. They're not really focused on empowering marginalized groups. The NRA and the NSSF, their main concern is creating a larger market
exactly.
for firearms. You know, they don't necessarily care about, you know, helping women become leaders, helping women, you know, defend their community and defend their spaces. Their interest is in, you know, how can we slap some pink grips on a Ruger and sell it to you, you know, and how can we get you into our special course that costs an extra $10 or whatever versus, you know, what you could normally get at a range. So I think that that's sort of the difference is, and I think that's something that we need to be aware of too as the SRA, how much are, you know, capitalism corrupts everything in this country, in this economy. So how can we make sure that we are focusing on creating a community and on empowering people who are in marginalized groups versus simply creating another market for firearms manufacturers?
Yeah. And the last thing I'll add on that, directly to your question about how to sort of get over that hump and stuff is, you know, SRA should show up at other events, right? Like if there's a women's march or a Black Lives Matter march, anti-ICE demonstrations, something like Standing Rock, the SRA should be there. You know, not to recruit, not to be cynical and try to say, hey, join us. No entryism, but just humbly show up and say, we're here for you. And that goes a long way in showing other organizations and in other communities that, oh, the SRA is really, you know, they're really pulling their weight. They showed up when we needed them, and that's going to cause those good bonds to be strengthened over time. So the SRA does not need to be, you know, something separate from the broader left movement. It should be embedded in it, and that's one way you can really get the SRA into these areas with other communities and diversify our overall membership.
So my boy Rob over there, that's Mango, by the way, We do a lot of recruiting in the SF Bay Area. So what we do is to take into account the environment of the people that we're trying to recruit as well. I'm not saying that we should make assumptions, but given where we live, we have a decent advantage as far as politics goes and as far as diverse identities go. But we're majorly disadvantaged as far as firearms goes. So what we've learned is that although we are primarily like a firearms educational organization, that kind of is not like a backseat, but definitely sort of not a driver in the passenger seat sort of situation, where we focus more on self-defense and community defense as a whole. And the firearms kind of just come in later as soon as we open that door. We'll talk about how we have the fire or the respirator mask fundraiser that we have going on. Providing masks for vulnerable populations is an act of community defense. We're talking about working with other organizations for supporting or helping tend to community gardens. Food security is a matter of community defense. So it's things like that are outside of, I guess, firearms, allows for an opportunity for these people to, I guess, figure out what it really means to defend yourself and to defend your community. And then along the lines, hopefully, they'll open their mind to firearms.
Yeah, I really love that idea of broadening the concept of self-defense to be, yeah, it's awesome.
Thank you. My name is, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My name is Brad from the Wichita chapter. This one was mostly for Alex, but yeah, you other two can chime in if you want. I was saying that I agree with what you're saying about the bargaining contract not being far off from worker self-management, but some of the most reactionary people I've met are active union members in my union, and they've got way different reasons for believing in the necessity of a union. And I was just wondering how you would suggest reaching out to those kind of people, because they've essentially weaponized the union for pretty, you know, bad stuff. But because I'm trying to get involved with it, with my own union, and it's honestly a pretty big uphill battle.
So, for some context, me and Brad are in the Machinists Union. The Machinists Union has a long and storied history with reactionary politics. It was a segregated union for up until the 50s, I believe. About the 40s or the 50s, coming out of World War II, they were forced to open their member rolls to non-white individuals. It's has a very, very reactionary past and has a very reactionary present that it has to come to terms with. In some ways, it's gotten better in terms of, if you go listen to the guys at my local, they'll complain about how the national leadership is too liberal and too progressive. Though I would view the views of the national leadership as their own form of reactionaryism at this point. But I think the problem is that we have to take the look at the fact that any form of socialism, regardless of your ideology, regardless of how you wish to implement the worker-owned means of production, has to grapple with the fact that just because if you took this country and you turned it over tomorrow and had some mechanism by which the workers could possess the means of production, could exert control over it, if you just did that tomorrow, you would not solve many of the problems we have here in America. You're not going to solve a lot of these problems just by implementing your own form of leftism or whatnot. We all have our opinions on how it's implemented, but every form of leftism in America must grapple with many different issues that are both tied to and external of economic conditions. Racial conditions are tied to economic conditions via a long and storied history that America has on race and ethnicity. You can't just solve that tomorrow by giving everyone the ability to elect their boss or by instituting a central committee at the national level and nationalizing the economy and planning it. That's there are ways to fix it within those systems. In every system, there are ways to address these issues. But looking at it from a purely economic standpoint is just a shortcoming that some leftists have of this notion that if we could just institute socialism, everything would be fine. And that's not correct. I mean, even looking at it from a philosophical standpoint, the whole idea of Marxism is a history of one class replacing the other, moving from, you know, pre-society to ancient society, to feudalism, to industrial capital, to socialism, to communism, to whatnot. It is a long progression of going from one system to the next. I think that socialism is the next logical step. I'm not actually sure if that's going to be the last step or if some new unforeseen system takes its place, and that might be because socialism ends up being unable to answer these questions, or otherwise people are unable to effectively answer them within the framework, and there might be another framework that pops up that is more able to address that. I can't philosophize on that because I have no idea. As far as in the here and now, what we can do, I think representation and the first cautious steps being taken is just the most important thing in these things. There's, you know, people have their opinions about the IWW. If you can get your workplace organized with the IWW, that's great. They just have some organizational problems right now that I won't get into. But if you have a union that you belong to and it is filled with reactionaries, I think the best way I've found in talking to people who are...
Hands in front of the mic.
Oh. That are in one way or another either neutral or openly hostile to the idea of leftism. I mean, I have a machine operator who does a drivematic, punches rivets in all day, who openly hates communists and would prefer to see them all dead. But nonetheless, I'm able to... I think that's the thing, too, that the internet left sometimes makes us forget that, like, I don't get the option of just being like, oh, I'm not going to associate myself with you. I work with this person every single day. I don't get to just cancel them on Twitter and move on with my life. There's real material conditions I have to affect in the now. And the best way I've been able to do that is to discuss the contradictions. Reactionary ideology is in response to the contradictions of the current system of capital, and forcing people to come to terms with those contradictions, I find 9 times out of 10 usually leads them towards a more left-leaning route, unless they are just openly fascist and believe that the final solution is the only solution. I mean, and if you've gotten to that point, then I'm not sure what advice is left to give. The last time we had that, we had a world war to figure that out. So
I can definitely say that, you know, socialism will not solve all of the problems in America or the world. You know, at the end of the day, whatever system of government or whatever economic system is in place will ultimately serve the interests of the people who have power in that system. And if we give that power to working class people, then honestly, that'll help working class people as a class. But you're still going to have those internal divisions within the working class. You're still going to have, you know, working class people who work against their interests. You know, you can talk about, you know, climate change is this huge impending disaster that we need to deal with as soon as possible. Like within, I think there's an article recently that said we have 18 months to solve the political problem of fixing climate change. And then we have 8 years to solve the technological and economic problems, which basically means it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. But if we had a socialist economy and a socialist system of government, we still have 40-45% of the population that doesn't believe that climate change is real and would probably vote against reducing their standard of living to fix it. So it's sort of like there are problems outside of the oppression of the working class that need to be solved concurrent with, you know, advancing, you know, socialist economic and political goals. You know, that also sort of ties into, I guess, what you could call the dirtbag left, stupid poll, those sort of you know, I would call them reactionary parts of the radical left, where they want to focus on this purely class reductionist, you know, economic analysis. Like, you can focus on that, but that's not going to solve the huge racial disparity in America. Like, you can still have racial discrimination within socialism, and that's still going to be a problem. You know, you can still have patriarchy within socialism. That's still going to be a problem. We have to push forward, and, you know, it's really a matter of not just changing the system, but also changing people, changing their minds, you know? You know, at the end of the day, we have to convince people that this is what is best, this is what needs to be done in order to ensure the safety and well-being of all. And, you know, you can't just jettison people along the way and throw them under the bus and expect things to work out fine, because, you know, we've sort of seen how that's played out.
Yeah, and all I'll say is, if we take history seriously, then we know that every single revolution in all of human history has just been the start, right? And after every successful overthrow of some despot or dictator, all those problems that you know would ostensibly be solved just by transitioning to a new system, those contradictions are just, they blow up in your face and you have to navigate them. You know, it's really like after the successful revolution is when the real problems start. That's when like the hard shit happens, you know? And I think all of history is a testament to that. So we should learn our lessons from history.
Next question.
All right, so this one's an older one from actually the beginning. So Ayla from Colorado wants to know what y'all think is the most common misconception about anarchism.
So there's a, like it's sort of a two-pronged, like funny, like stereotypes about anarchists and communists. Like communists get the whole 1984 Big Brother, we all wear gray jumpsuits and like walk in single file line things. And then like the big stereotype of anarchists is that bomb throwers, right? Anarchy, chaos. I even heard, I think it was Joe Rogan had on Andy No, I mean, after that big scuffle in Portland recently. And they were trying, and Joe Rogan, you know, infinitely ignorant about everything, is asking Andy, like, what is anarchism, you know? And Andy is supposed to be this journalist that's been studying the movement and knows what it means. And he just deferred to the old stereotypes. He's like, what these people believe in is chaos. They want anarchy, like all anarchists are jokers, you know, trying to just sow seeds of chaos and instability. That's the exact opposite of what anarchism really is. So that propaganda campaign to stereotype anarchists in that specific way, that's not an accident. That was very much a propaganda campaign by the enemies of the left over many years. And sure, there were anarchists in the day that threw bombs. That did happen. But so I think that would be like the big misconception. When people hear the word anarchism, they hear anarchy, they hear chaos. And so that's probably the obvious one.
I think another big one is the idea that anarchy means, you know, no rules, no organization of anything at all, just total, like you said, chaos. And, you know, this sort of idea that anarchists disavow any and all sorts of forms of organizing or working together. When you look at it historically, the vast majority of anarchists have worked in organizations like the IWW, you know, and other formations that have, you know, worked together to, you know, just because you're an anarchist doesn't mean that you can't have a structure. It doesn't mean that you can't have an organization that you work within. And, you know, there's certain strains of anarchism like insurrectionism or, you know, egoism or whatever that focus very much on the individual. But the vast majority of anarchists historically, the ones, you know, that made, you know, progress like in Spain, like in Ukraine, like in, you know, like in the labor movement in America, the anarchists that really made a difference and really, you know, made a mark on leftist history were the anarchists who were willing to work together and willing to organize on large scale. And that's historically what anarchism has been. You know, I think Anarcho-Pack on YouTube and Twitter, she's a historian working on her PhD, I believe, on anarchism. And, you know, going back and reading, you know, this theory and actually reading documents and notes and bylaws of anarchist organizations throughout the world, throughout history. And, you know, it really is clear that anarchism is much more than just fuck authority. It's really about being able to work with other people and build relationships and, you know, relate to people on equal terms without having, you know, a baked-in hierarchy necessarily. And, you know, making sure that everything is democratic and representative. And I think that that's, like, I think that that's the best takeaway from anarchist theory and anarchist history. And I think that that's like the most important aspect of anarchism to work into our present, you know, movements. The other biggest misconception that I've run into from right-wingers is the idea that anarchy is a right-wing political philosophy because it's about small government. I don't think I need to go into the whys too much, but you know, I do think that there's a big problem of just a complete lack of real political education or understanding among a wide swath of the American population. Like, most people these days don't even get civics classes. I didn't have one in my high school. I had to learn that on my own. A lot of people, you know, their political theory is just stuff that they've cobbled together from propaganda, you know, from the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or what, or libertarians or whatever. Most people don't really have any knowledge of political theory. They're just figuring it out on their own, and you pair that with prideful stupidity and, well, you get anarchism is the ultimate right-wing ideology. So I think that's something to be aware of, is these, a lot of times people don't necessarily have a cohesive ideology, they're just confused. And so when you're talking to someone about anarchism or Marxism, that's something that you should always keep in mind.
And just really quick, sorry, why sometimes we on the left obsess with these minor minutia of differences between different sects and stuff. Look at the far right. Like, these are the people that thought Obama was a Marxist communist. You know, so why we're over here being like, oh, you know, 1917 should have went this way and that way, like, hating each other over this shit. The far right, we're all the same. Everybody to the left of Nancy Pelosi is a communist. So we should really understand how our enemies perceive us too. And they perceive us just as one big block. So it doesn't matter if you're the most centrist neoliberal Democrat or like the most committed Marxist-Leninist. To the right, we're all the same, and you know, we all need to be purged from the country, sort of thing. So keep that in mind as well. Damn, I wish Obama was a communist.
I wish Nancy Pelosi was a communist.
Okay, so it looks like questions from the stream have stopped coming in. I do have a question, and then we'll turn it to the floor if they have any other questions. Brett, you mentioned radical empathy earlier. I like using the term radical love. Hmm. What do those terms mean to you?
Ooh, that's a good one. One way to approach this is like, it's sort of like Buddhism informs us a little bit too, this idea that yourself isn't where you stop, right? Like, to have healthy individuals, you need healthy communities. To have healthy communities, they need to be composed of healthy individuals. There isn't this split between the communal and the individualist, like many philosophies on the center and right like to pretend. So, if we take this idea seriously, that you know we're embedded in these social contexts, and that there is no, I mean, there's no language without other human beings. If you're not born into a social context, you don't develop language, you don't develop a self. You don't develop that little voice that you talk to yourself in your head all day with, right? And so weakening this idea of like, I am me and my interests end, you know, at the tip of my fingers, and everybody, that's the world out there is external to me, you know, to really have a radical empathy or a radical love means to break those borders down, right, between you and the world, and to see yourself as a part of something much bigger. And once you do that, then it's very hard to see somebody else's genuine suffering and not feel it on some level as your own. So I guess it's a tough question, but I guess that would be like my first opening salvo at how to address that, I think. I don't know. Anybody have any ideas? Like, what does it mean to you?
Yeah, I think it's really... For me, radical empathy is really being able to, you know, put myself outside of my own context of, you know, how I perceive the world, and being able to, you know, look at things from the perspective of, you know, a colonized, you know, a person from a colonized culture or of a diaspora person, and being able to understand how the systems of oppression in our world, both political, social, and economic, how they affect people differently and how we interact with those systems, you know. Like, I think we, in our episode, I think it was called Radical Solidarity, we talked about, you know, the need to you know, with regards to especially Black people protesting against police brutality and police violence, you know, as a white person, I have to be able to listen to them and respect, you know, their perspective as a person who is a subject of that violence and of that oppression. And instead of thinking about ways that, oh, well, how can, you know, what do I think should be done about the police? Instead, you know, you should be able to look at it in terms of how can I fit into helping you in your struggle? You know, I think the IAF FAI came up with a way of phrasing it that I thought was really clever. You know, vulnerable communities don't need allies, they need accomplices. You know, they need people who can show up and do the work that they need help doing, rather than coming in and imposing this other, you know, our own viewpoints over top of it and trying to work other people into our own political project. We need to show up and, you know, be a part of their political project and then show how that can tie into a larger coalition and a larger, you know, movement to make change in this country and the world. So I think that's a really important aspect of it, is just being able to, you know, accede to other people's viewpoints who are more directly affected by these things.
Just really quick before you ask, you can. I just want to say, like, you know, there's that quote: "An injury to one is an injury to all." You know, and that's there for a reason. In the face of climate catastrophe and insurgent fascism, what neoliberal centrism says is just recoil into your personal life and consume. Right? Just go watch Netflix. Go try to get a good job. Get your status. Keep buying. By all means, keep buying. I mean, after the Iraq or after 9/11, what did Bush say? He's like, go out and shop. You know, so what they want you to do is to recoil into your personal life in the face of all this horror and dystopia that we're being dragged into. The last thing they want you to do is to form community and fight back, because collective struggle is literally the only way that we're going to escape the absolute worst dystopia in the next couple decades. Sorry, though. Go ahead.
First, I just want to say I completely agree with your take on the radical empathy. It's awesome to hear other people thinking that way. And then sort of tying that into our work, as I understand it now, in our bylaws, like, we're not allowed to, we're not supposed to be participating in protests or acts of riot as agents of the SRA, but at the same time, we do eagerly want to fill supportive roles to these communities that are pushed to those points, and I'm wondering, like, where is our place? Like, what actual examples of filling a role like that without putting the organization at a risk for, losing its status as a nonprofit, for instance, or not being effective? You know, what can we actually do to be supportive in those ways?
So I think the most important thing is to understand that the SRA is an educational organization. So we're here to give people the skills and the knowledge that they need to that they can then apply in their other political projects. You know, one thing that I've mentioned in the last couple, three episodes of the podcast is, you know, the SRA, unless you are focused on being an SRA organizer and this is your passion, if you're just a regular member, the SRA should not be your only point of engagement with the radical left or radical struggles in general. You know, the SRA should be a place to build community. It should be a place to learn. It should be a place to, you know, develop your skill set as a leftist, as an organizer, to become a more, you know, effective activist and, you know, to become, you know, a better able to defend your community. But at the end of the day, because of our structure as a nonprofit, we cannot act as a community defense organization outside of, you know, the sort of disaster relief and, you know, mutual aid roles that we've taken on. So, you know, SRA chapters are welcome to show up to protests, but if you show up as an SRA chapter and you're wearing SRA gear and you go and you punch a fascist or something, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to discipline you for that, even though I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing to do. That's not something that is allowable within the SRA as an organization. We are focused on, you know, education and outreach and helping people learn how to organize. If you want to do that sort of thing, you know, you're a private citizen, you're free to do whatever you like and as you take part in any other organization, but that's not who we are, that's not what we're here for. We're outreach, education, advocacy.
And I think that plays into the whole idea of safety, right? We were talking earlier about the threat of left-wingers arming themselves in any context historically. And so, you know, making sure that these things are very well understood and that as members of this organization, we are all responsible to keeping each other safe means that we can't, you know, in the name of the SRA, take those drastic actions. But I totally agree that the SRA, both as, you know, chapters and individual members, they need to be tied into other organizing efforts. You know, the SRA can't last as just sort of an isolated formation in and of itself. It needs to be embedded in broader organizing efforts. That's absolutely essential for the health and growth of this organization overall.
Yeah, one thing that I've sort of been thinking about, and I've sort of been thinking of how to talk about it, is the idea of the organization, not just of like left-wing organizations, but how do we build and organize relationships between organizations and create an ecosystem, essentially, you know, of organizations that can fulfill different roles, that can go out and do different things. Like, I think the SRA is really valuable as an education resource, but in order for it to be truly effective, there also need to be, you know, community defense organizations that people can then turn to and take part in those as they're, you know, as they're interested in doing, or, you know, and taking part in any sort of radical struggle. Like if you want to take part in BLM or any sort of, you know, any sort of protest movement like that, or if you want to be a part of a party or an electoral formation, you know, there's not one single organization that is going to be, you know, the vanguard of the left. I'm sorry, Marxist-Leninist, but there's...
Well, now, hold on there.
there's no single organization, like, as things stand today, that is going to be, like, the forefront of the left that's going to carry things forward. Like, there's, like, 100 things that we need to be doing and that we need to be addressing, and we need organizations that can focus on one or two or three things and do those things very well and build relationships with other organizations that are focusing on other issues and create an ecosystem that can push... of organizations and activists that can push forward on many different fronts. So again, we need people who can step up and can be SRA chapter organizers and national organizers eventually, but I also encourage people to become involved in other organizations, both local and national, and, you know, take your political participation beyond just community defense. Make this one facet of what you do. And, you know, sort of as you're able to, take that out and, you know, take the skills that you develop here and apply them elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, if you can organize a range day, you can organize a food not bomb program. You can organize a tenant. You can organize your workplace even. So those skill sets are transferable across, you know, different organizations and approaches.
Absolutely.
I think an important thing to remember as well when it comes to the SRA and what we do is that there are other organizations that fill other roles, and this is why it's always interesting when people ask why we aren't more like Redneck Revolt or John Brown Gun Club. I think the left has a long tradition of creating multiple redundant organizations, and that kind of has stymied our efforts throughout the years, but the SRA as it exists now fills a niche that we don't really have filled on the left, and that is essentially office space advocacy, as it were, that this organization isn't out there to pound the streets and get things done out there, because there are already plenty of organizations out there that do that and have better infrastructure built up for it. We don't need to go build up even more competing dual power structures, because then that's not dual power. You've just building two bridges is good. Building five, it's not as good. Yes. So I think when, you know, looking at what we can do, definitely, like Faye said, we have no restrictions on dual carding. Go work for other organizations as well and do work with them. Just know that also here at the SRA, our focus is trying to provide the administrative backbone, that the vanguard is not built only by having folks out in masks in the streets. Like, that's having people with that skill set is, you know, something that some people think is necessary, and we can have a discussion about that at some other point, but regardless of one's viewpoints on how revolutionary praxis happens, be it via electoralism, be it via vanguard, be it via workplace organizing, there will always be people who are direct action-oriented, and there will always be people who are administrative back-end. Neither is less important than the other, but neither is going to be able to function without having the other to support it. We can't go out and do the things that sometimes need to be done as far as groups like Redneck Revolt go and do. We don't. You'll never get an insurance company to issue you an insurance policy if you tell them that your mission statement is to show up armed to protests. Nobody's going to cover you. That exists in a different realm, but that's still necessary to be able to have those open carry protests. We exist in a realm where we can go and get insurance to be able to protect the organization and its membership, while also being able to fulfill, while those folks at John Brown Gun Club are out in the streets doing open carry protests, we're creating an educational backbone so that people can go and join them, so that people have the knowledge and the experience necessary, and we work to keep the system at bay for as long as we can of making sure that they still have the ability to go out there and open carry, because as we've seen before with like California, if it gets to a certain point, then yes, both the liberal and the conservative factions within government will unite along the common purpose of ensuring that ideologies that are not conducive to conservative or liberal capitalism survival, is they're going to unite for their own common survival.
We have about 10 minutes left.
I think we can take one or two more questions.
Hi. I'm Jason, he, him, on the Slack. I go by Eugene Plebs. And I'm from Northeast Alabama, and so my question's kind of related to that. My chapter is kind of spread out. I've never met anybody in my chapter. And so this question is kind of for anybody in the room who's had this experience and who can shed some light. What can we do to make sure that we like get together more? I mean, is there anything, any kind of specific tips beyond just, well, you know, find a day that everybody's good on, because we can't, apparently. Thank you.
If you have something, if you have a thought you'd like to, okay, put it on me. That is a challenge. It's not a question that I know that I'm best equipped to answer, because I'm in Los Angeles, and it's, but at the same time, we sort of have the similar issue that even though it's a big city and it's a very condensed space, LA is a big city, you know, we have members who are 3 hours apart drive time. One of the approaches that you can take in that sort of situation is sort of having a federated chapter and, you know, going out and trying to find people in your local community, you know, through any other organizations in your area, and, you know, building up relationships with people that you can meet up with, who are within a good driving distance, who you can, you know, find a date and get together on, because it's really hard to organize, you know, something like that over, if you're spread over half a state, you know, just doing that online, that's sort of hard to, you know, even call a chapter if you haven't really set up meetings or anything. So in that case, I would recommend focusing on your immediate community, focusing on, you know, people who are near to you. And then you can sort of federate that and have smaller chapters throughout a state. Because sometimes, you know, people just end up biting off too big an area than they can chew, and that can lead to problems. So if you want to go ahead, Rob?
Yeah, hey there. Sorry, my voice is loud. Beth Bay Area chapter, one of the organizers. My answer to that question is, for those folks who are new organizers or have limited organizing experience, I was there. I'm going to let you know that as an organizer that's new, you're probably going to make some mistakes, and things aren't always going to go according to plan with getting everybody on spot, getting everybody to agree to one day. One of the things that we eventually had to do as our chapter to get our feet off the ground was just to say, this is the day. This is the day that we're always going to have meetings every month. You know, if you can make it, excellent. We want to see you there. If you can't, we're going to find a way to make things more accessible so that you can participate. Okay, where some of us are spread out in the San Francisco Bay Area, our area of responsibility covers everything from Petaluma, the Napa area, as far south as Santa Cruz, and everything in between. And to put it in more perspective, there's a big body of water in between all of that. And so to make ourselves more accessible, we organize via other forums or other means. We plan things way in advance. We try to do a public lands weekend where we say, hey, once a quarter, expect, you know, on this month, our range day is going to be swapped out with a weekend event where we can all come together. It's 3 months in advance so that people can get that time off, hopefully, or make those plans and get out there. We set up the logistics for carpools. Who's driving? Okay, who needs a ride? Those little questions. Ask ahead of time. Ask early instead of waiting until the last minute. And just ensure people that, hey, if you can't make it to this one, there's going to be more. We're not going anywhere. You know, when it comes to our chapter meetings, again, we have people that have great ideas and that are amazing to have at our chapters, our meetings, but they can't always make it because of proximity. So we've opted to do a stream for our meetings, and that allows people to listen in and also write down questions, kind of like what we're doing now. So that helps out get participation. Encourage people to stay in contact, and I also encourage if you are an organizer and you get somebody who shows up to one meeting but kind of drops off the radar, take some initiative and reach out to them. Let them know, like, hey, I noticed that you haven't been able to make it. What's going on? You know, the only way that we understand what's going on with our various membership, the diversity of our members, is if we ask and that we listen. But I guess what it comes down to is regularity. I'm sorry for rambling. Regularity and keeping open ears and listening to your members. That's all I got. Does that answer your question? Okay.
That's great.
Right, we have 3 minutes left, so maybe one question, and if there's any time after that, maybe a lightning round.
All right.
Well, could I add on to what Rob was saying? I don't want to like hijack the podcast, though. Is that okay?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I like listening, yeah.
Well, Rob, I just wanted to emphasize on what Rob was saying about establishing a personal relationship with your members as an organizer and even as a member yourself. This isn't like a classmate that you're sitting next to at some firearms course. These are your comrades now. So none of that shoulder-to-shoulder BS. This is face-to-face, and you always want to personally check in on them, especially if they drop off, you know, because a lot of the times, a lot of the people that our groups tend to attract are maybe a bit of an outcast, or they're trying to find somewhere to fit in, and they came to us for that. If we don't check in on them, if they leave, there's a pretty big likelihood that no one will. So being part of the SRA and being a comrade is a big responsibility in and of itself, because we have to be there for each other.
Thank you, Mango. That's really...
I love that, yeah.
All right, one more question, if we've got one, and then I think we'll wrap up.
Yeah, we have a minute left, but that's fine. You can go a little bit over.
Oh, sure.
Excuse me. I'm JB Roback from Tryon, North Carolina chapter. Figures 1 minute, I could throw in a goofball question.
Sure.
Let's say PSA has contacted you for their next meme lower. What is your meme lower?
No.
I didn't even hear what it was. What?
PSA is a notorious gun shop that sells cheap merch, but also like makes Kekistan lowers and stuff like that.
I don't know. I still kind of want a selector lever that is thesis, antithesis, synthesis, but I'm just a nerd like that, so.
So it is 4:50, but we technically get out at 5. So if folks have concluding thoughts or, you know, lightning round, real simple, easy questions, that's after a long theoretical discussion that we've had on many things. Anything, everything.
Well, I sort of want to put a question to you, Brett.
Okay.
You know, based on your experience with the SRA and, you know, what we've been doing, you know, what do you think is the most important thing that the, like, what would you like to see the SRA do in the coming year?
I would like to see, I mean, I like the idea of, like, the orientation towards safety and not being adventurous and being, you know, sort of the administrative backbone of the burgeoning left-wing gun movement. I really like that. I would like to see just, like, long-term, like, this organization grow to a point where there's a funding base that the national organization can use to maybe facilitate some people in rural areas that maybe need to travel, you know. Having a national organization in any sphere, one of the best things that the possibilities present themselves is a funding base that you can help chapters get up and go and get people connected, have regional meetups, if not national ones, you know, mm-hmm. stuff like that. But broadly, I mean, I'm a part of the SRA because I love the direction that is going, and I believe in this direction, and I believe in the people running the national. So, like, I don't have any real critiques. I'm just hopeful, and I want to play whatever humble role I can in, like, helping this organization continue to develop, because I think it's promising, and it's going to become increasingly necessary. Things aren't going to get better. In the face of climate change, things aren't going to get any better. They're going to get worse, and so shit like this is super important.
Absolutely. All right. Alex, you have any concluding thoughts?
Not really. No, I'm just not all there right now. No, I think it went pretty good. I think going to be, I definitely think, as kind of conclusion to this segment and the day as a whole, I think we are in for a good weekend. We have about 15 or so people more to show up tomorrow. Get with Front Range folks. They're sitting over there. If you want to go do Front Range activities, the Front Range chapter was considering doing a range day. I know not everyone has come equipped, but, you know, even if you don't, I'm believe Colorado sportsmanship laws say that you're allowed to use a comrade's gun at the range. So, yes, as long as you provide ammo and do your part.
And even says that in the law, comrades, yes. Specifically.
So, get with Front Range folks if you want to do something with the Front Range chapter. Otherwise, it is 5:00. The night is still very much young. If you want to spend some time in the city before getting down to things on the next 2 days, definitely go and enjoy yourselves and get ready for much more politicking on the next 2 days, I guess.
Thank you, everybody, for coming out. I think it's been really good.